The systems approach says identify the binding frictions in an environment and alleviate the frictions, and then let the system itself naturally respond. So it becomes a much more actor-led reform as opposed to an externally imposed reform.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. What's the fairest and most efficient way to improve not just access to education, but the outcomes too? Should we prioritize the interventions the research has shown to be effective? Or could policymakers focus on a broader markets and systems approach to education reform? Recently, I spoke to Emiliana Vegas of the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Asim Khwaja of Harvard Kennedy School about what a systems approach is and what it could achieve. I began by asking Asim, with Sustainable Development Goal 4 aiming for universal quality education, what's the good news and the bad news about our progress to achieving that target?
First of all, I should say the fact that the world is focusing rightly on education, both between the MDGs and the SDGs, I think is good news. I think we have, as a result of that, not just increased spending in education, but we've achieved a lot of enrollment gains. There still is an out-of-children issue, but you know, we've made tremendous progress on that. And so I think that's the good news. The bad news, I guess, or I would say the next challenge, and this is reflected again in the SDGs as well, is a focus on quality. So now that we're getting increasing number of students in school, we better make sure we give them high quality education. And there, both amongst the rich and the poor countries, we've struggled with raising educational quality as measured by things like test scores. And there's also a richer debate now beginning to happen about shouldn't we be thinking also beyond test scores?
Budgets are under pressure, aren't they? So is this due to a lack of investment?
I don't think so, actually. We could always use more money, but my view is money follows things when things are productive. And I think if you were to ask me what the basic issue in education right now, it's not that there's lack of money, it's that are we generating enough value for money, enough productivity in education? And my view is if we are, not only will we make better use of the money we have, but also we'll attract more money, honestly. And the money doesn't have to be public, it could be private, it could be nonprofit as well.
There has been huge efforts from governments to increase the share of government spending that goes to education across the board. The issue is that not all of it is being allocated in the best, most productive areas. For example, a lot of countries spend way much more in higher education. That brings a lot more private returns to the beneficiaries than early education, primary education, and even secondary education, where students gain those basic skills they need to continue learning. So misallocation, and I would also argue that there are enormous differences in the average spending per pupil between low-income countries and the rest of the world. So there's still a need to increase the overall size of spending in the poorest countries.
But if I'm a policymaker at the moment, might I, should I conclude that perhaps some of that budget should be diverted into other projects where there might be a greater return at the moment?
Absolutely not. I think the evidence and the returns to education, even in systems that don't deliver great learning outcomes, is very strong in favor of investing in education. Not just because the returns for individuals in terms of earnings, in terms of employment rates are high in every country, but also because there are other externalities as a result of investing in education that accrue, for example, in better health outcomes, in better, more responsible use of our planet, and therefore improving our environment, and lots of intergenerational benefits. So the children of better educated parents also tend to have better outcomes.
When we think of investment in education, we just shouldn't just think of the public space or policymakers. There's a lot of private investment in education that is happening, and I think that's critical to recognize. And honestly, private investment follows when you have productivity behind it. And so I think that's a welcome thing. I don't think we should be worried about it. It's a complement to public education. So there are ways that these different styles of investment complement and add to each other.
So I'm part of the board of directors of the Jacobs Foundation, which is one of the largest foundations that support global education. And the work we do through Jacobs is really trying to improve the evidence on what works to improve learning and address the fact that children learn differently for various reasons and throughout time. And so educators have to face very diverse sets of students, and that also creates challenges for their effectiveness in providing an effective learning environment. And so on the one hand, we are investing a lot on generating evidence, but equally important is really who uses this evidence and how does it get to policymakers and really to make change and eventually to classrooms and to affect improve children's outcomes. And so we're working across the board and trying to really also partner with both government as well as, for example, companies that invest in education technology as well as scientists. So trying to build a lot of bridges across the different stakeholders.
So there has been quite a lot of research into how we can achieve value for money, better outcomes, specifically quite a lot of RCT research into how better inputs into education might be able to help. What have we tried? What have we learned about what works? And, well, what does it not tell us as well?
So there, I think, honestly, the kind of development revolution led by, say, places like the Poverty Action Lab at MIT, the Jamil Poverty Action Lab, JPAL, in development with Michael Kremer, Abhijit Banerjee, and Esther Duflo-1, very much was a testament to generating just an inordinate and really valuable amount of research using randomized controlled trials, kind of the gold standard for our evaluation. A lot of the work that they've done is on education across the board. They have some phenomenal reviews on things that work. This has led to Best Buys, big wins that organizations like FCDO and others have rightly celebrated. So I think there is a lot of research on these areas. The one challenge has been what Emiliana alluded to, which is there is now research evidence, and, you know, foundations are trying to produce more research, like Jacobs that Emiliana mentioned, and JPAL and others, research entities. But the question is, are policymakers going to adopt it? Is that going to be contextually appropriate for where we're working? Is that going to be politically bought into or not? There's a whole bunch of what we are now beginning to think of as implementation science questions, which is, we have the evidence, now how do we get it to scale up and sustain?
To address that, you have been talking about a systems markets approach instead. What does it mean when you talk about that?
Yeah, so I think it's partly as a complement to kind of the approach that I just mentioned. When you think of education, there are kind of two ways to think about it. One way to think about education is the production function of education. You think education is produced by a set of X number of inputs, call them X1 to X1000, however many you want. And the idea is that we can proceed by figuring out what happens when you change each of these inputs, right? So if X15 goes up, what happens to learning quality? And in many ways, the empirical revolution and development has given us a very precise estimate of what happens when X15 goes up. And then in theory, a policymaker can do all these studies and then figure out which one of the inputs is appropriate for their context. In practice, this space is very complicated to navigate. You know, the same input may work in one place, but not in the other place. The same input would work in one time, but not work the next year. Mm-hmm. And so what I've been doing a lot more in the research that I've done on my own, and many others are using a similar approach, is this more systems approach. And there the idea is it's less about focusing on which input to pick, because that's really hard. It's much more about recognizing who are the actors who are active in your educational ecosystem. So there's students, there's parents, there's teachers, there's public schools, there's private schools, there's nonprofit schools, there's educational intermediaries, there's textbook providers, there's regulators, there's tutors. Even in the poorest of places, it's a very rich space. Mm-hmm. And the systems approach first maps all the relevant actors in any ecosystem. Then it asks, how do we achieve the education-oriented objectives of these actors? What are the frictions they face? So for instance, when parents are trying to figure out which school to pick and send their child to, which is gives them the best value for money, do they have the information to pick? When teachers are trying to improve their skills, do they have access to learning resources that can allow them to improve their skills? When schools are trying to grow and develop, do they have the support from the public sector, or if they're a private school, from financiers to be able to grow and expand? The systems approach says identify the binding frictions in an environment and alleviate the frictions, and then let the system itself naturally respond. The power of this approach is when you alleviate a friction, you don't necessarily need to a priori pick an input. You don't need to worry about the exact content of teacher training. The teacher can himself or herself say, look, I'm really weak in math, or I really would like experience in how to teach a troubled child, or I really want experience in how to use technology. So it becomes a much more actor-led reform as opposed to an externally imposed reform. My sense is that also brings in better political buy-in, because one of those actors that you should think about is politicians. They have their own constraints. You know, how do we get them to invest in education? Well, if you could link education to eventually getting votes, that's going to create an incentive for them to want to invest in education in their area. So that could be a political constraint or political friction that you may want to evaluate. And I'd say the last thing this approach does is, if you're really serious about this and thoughtful about it, you would try to alleviate a friction which crowds in other investments as opposed to crowds out. So you can think about, if I were to do this, would other actors respond? So just to make it very tangible, imagine I'm doing something at school and trying to improve a child's learning. Is that going to substitute away from effort that parents may put at home? Or is that going to induce them to put in more effort?
You can
design interventions in ways where they induce parental support, or where parents say, well, I don't need to do anything because the school is doing it. And that's going to be a net loss then, because whatever the school does is undone by the parents as opposed to accentuated and increased by the parents.
This isn't just theory, is it? You point out that it has been used very effectively in Pakistan's education system. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Together with Jishnu Das, who used to be at the World Bank and now is Georgetown, and Tahir Indrabi, who's a faculty member at Pomona, we've been working on this project called the LEAPS Project. If you Google LEAPS and Pakistan, you'll kind of see the work. Mm-hmm. We've been really exactly working on the evidence behind this. So we've spent about 2 decades now. And if I were to summarize the work, we've alleviated a range of frictions in the system, from information to labor markets to financial frictions to teacher pedagogical frictions. And each time we've done this, we've then measured how the entire ecosystem, or at least what we could capture with our surveys, responds to that. And we've picked up interventions which we think have these positive effects. The most recent two papers I'd allude to is both were looking at financing. One was for private schools and the other was for public schools. We find when the private sector improves, a public responds. And when the public sector improves, a private sector responds. And so this idea of choosing a friction which encourages competition and allows both sectors to respond makes a massive difference. I'll give one last example on this, which is we have this project on private school financing. Once you recognize these system responses, it makes a huge difference what policy would be. So we did this randomized experiment at the system level, where in some markets, in some villages, we picked only one school to receive money. In other villages, we picked all schools to receive money. Mm-hmm. And what we find is fascinating. The response to that is very different. When you only pick one school to give money to, you effectively make that school act like a monopolist. The school is the only player in town, and it invests that money by basically expanding capacity and essentially steals children from other schools. If you think of it, it's like a market stealing strategy. Yeah. When you give every school money, that strategy no longer makes sense because everyone can put an extra room. And so in that world, what happens is they all invest in teachers and raise quality and raise fees. So both ways lead to an increased revenue for schools, but in one way they do it by market stealing and the other way they do it by market growing. And we then argue in that paper is that this is a really important insight for policymakers, because unfortunately, a lot of the ways often multilaterals, places like the IFC, give money is we actually empower monopolies. We don't increase competition by giving money. When we pick winners, mm-hmm. we create players which have monopoly power, and that worsens competition. And so now we're advocating that when you give money, you should saturate the market so that everyone has an opportunity to avail of what you're doing. And that way you enhance competition, and that gives you a bigger effect, a bigger social effect than you would have otherwise done. So that's just an example of the kind of work that we've been doing.
Emiliana, in Chile, there's been a constant focus on this type of education reform. What sort of policies have been enacted there?
During my student days, I did my dissertation looking at the teacher labor markets in Latin America. And I particularly focused on Chile because it was one of the few countries back then, this is the early 2000s, that had already had a decade of regular student assessments conducted every year. So you could see what was happening between private and public schools system-wide, like Azim was saying. But over the years, as I was working first at the World Bank and then as head of the education division at the Inter-American Development Bank, I had the opportunity to provide technical assistance to various governments, various ministers of education as they embarked on system-wide reform. So the first thing is that in the 1980s, during the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet, there was a very pro-market decision to introduce competition and choice nationwide and to fund schools via per-student subsidy or a voucher, usually it's called, but it actually goes to the school as long as the family chooses to send their student there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the provision of schooling from the public sector was decentralized from the Ministry of Education to many different municipal governments. And so the responsibility to deliver public education was transferred from the central government to very local governments with different capacities and all locally elected. Mm-hmm. So we've had the opportunity now to see what's happened because we have so much data and the data has improved over many years and since democracy returned to Chile in 1990. What our research has shown is that when you have, let's say, I called it unfettered school choice, meaning that schools can select students, private schools select students, select teachers, can choose to, if their parent community agrees, to charge fees and still receive public funding, it leads to not a lot of improvement in quality and a lot of selling on things that parents might find interesting, like, for example, a funny English name, because people think that might mean a better education, but there's actually no English instruction even in the school. There's been a lot of research showing how schools marketed to the consumers, meaning the families, without actually improving until there was a lot of evidence of the fact that, including students themselves realizing that they weren't equally accessing university education because of a high stakes exam. And so there were nationwide protests that led to a lot of changes over many years. The first one was a change to the per-student subsidy that created incentives for schools to serve better students who were from poorer backgrounds. Also holding schools accountable, not just for whether students attend and enroll, but also whether they're learning. Things started to change and the gaps between schools, private and public, started narrowing. And also primarily students from poor and rich family backgrounds started narrowing as well. And then there were some other system-wide reforms that took place later, which was an effort to strengthen the capacity of the state to hold schools accountable for delivering quality by strengthening their capacity to not just assess, let's say, on math and reading, but also to provide information to schools that schools could use to improve. Detailed information about the performance of their students in other subjects. Also evaluate sort of the climate at the school level and reward schools that had better, safer, let's say, more inclusive school climates. And efforts to change the way in which students select schools in a way of giving students particularly a fair chance of getting into schools that they actually choose instead of letting schools what's called cream scheme students. And also a change to the teacher career to make it more merit-based. And with a lot of work with the teachers unions, which are very powerful in Chile and over many years, there's been the introduction and the strengthening of evaluations of teachers based on student learning and other variables that inform whether teachers advance in the career, whether they can stay in the profession, and what types of pay and compensation benefits they can have. And the better performers get much better salaries and compensation and also responsibilities.
No one would say they're against better education, but these are very big policy changes, aren't they? Have they been easy to push through? I'm thinking about the potential political problems that Asim was talking about.
They were not easy to push through. I think what there were some conditions that helped tremendously. And one of the reasons we were talking earlier about the importance of having evidence that is understood by society, Chile in the early 2000s started investing through their Council of Science and Innovation in consortia of universities who would get public funding to start a new research center to help inform education policy. Mm-hmm. And these are interdisciplinary, where sociologists, economists work together to use the data that the system was producing and put forth policy recommendations. So a lot of the evidence was showing from these centers, as well as from international researchers, that there was a lot of socioeconomic segregation. So meaning that students were attending schools with students of exactly the same backgrounds. There was an increasing awareness that this could create and was creating problems for the social cohesion and the democratic system that Chile had fought so hard to have. And so there were efforts to think about how do we break this circle of, let's say, exclusion, which affects social mobility and all sorts of other opportunities for individuals. And I think the turning point was this information becoming so evident and so well understood by everyone that there were enormous strikes in the country demanding quality education, demanding reforms twice. Once led by the secondary school students that led to the initial wave of reforms, and the second led by university students who were complaining about the high costs of university tuition and the exploitation of some private universities that were charging high costs and not delivering the type of education that would allow their graduates to get jobs and then pay back loans that they and their families had taken. One of those students is currently Boric, the president of Chile. I've worked across Latin America and the Caribbean, and I always say I have not seen many countries where you see nationwide protests demanding improvements in education quality and equity. I have seen a lot of protests from teachers demanding better pay and lots of strikes and walkouts for that, but never from students. Even the unions supported these reforms and were part of the design of them, which I think was also one of the reasons they have been able to be pushed through and sustained.
Asim, it's clear from what you've said that these success stories, they're not the rule. They seem to be the exception. So are there ways that you can think of that policymakers should be thinking about education policy differently?
We really are looking for a change in mindset and how we think about education. I mean, the fact that we haven't had improvements in test scores, say, in the US in the last 50 years, is a warning sign to say something more radically has to shift. Mm-hmm. And when I think of radical shifts, in addition to kind of the political pressure that Emiliana is saying, I think we need to recognize that we need to put political pressure on changing quality of education. But I think for the decision maker, the way they approach education has to be much more at the system level in a very thoughtful way. Let me give you four examples for why I think this matters and actually affects policy choices. So first, let's start with parents and children. So there has been a view, and it's not just in poor countries, we have that view also in impoverished areas in rich countries like the US, where we think parents and children don't care about education. And so we think they have to be cajoled and coaxed and, fear I say it, bribed to send their children to school. And this leads to strong programs like in Mexico, Oportunidades or Progresa, which was a conditional cash transfer to get parents to do the right thing. I'm sure between Emiliana and I, we must have met several hundred parents. I have yet to meet a parent who would say, I don't care about education, or I don't want to get my kid to use education as a means to improve themselves. I just haven't met those. I've searched for them, and I haven't met them. And in our data, we see exactly that reflected. So when you move from that traditional view of a parent and child who doesn't care to a view where the parent and child is desperately trying to do stuff, but is heavily faced by constraints, you have a very different style of policy which comes in. You don't do a conditional cash transfer. You try and support parental and child decision-making. And for older children, that may be, how do you choose which major to do? We're working on a project in Colombia with colleagues of mine, Juan Saavedra and Chris Nielsen and others, on really informing students when they make choices about college. There's great work by people like Basit Zafar and others in the US on that as well. And so this idea of empowering parents and children is a very different way of doing policy. So that's one. The second is we make the same mistake on the provider of education side. We have a very monolithic view. Education is only provided in schools, and for that matter, only within a typical type of school, which is typically a public school. Mm-hmm. When you recognize that education is provided in multiple ways, in most of the world, there is a non-public presence. In the developing world now, almost a third of enrollment is coming from low-cost private schools, not just elite schools, but low-cost private schools. It's coming from non-profit schools. And when you recognize that there's multiple actors, the policy changes from funding large public sector programs and thinking that the state has to both underwrite and deliver education to a world where the state starts realizing that these other agents who are delivering education are also within the state's ambit. So instead, you recognize education as an active marketplace and the state's funding and policies. I mean, Chile is exactly the example that Mirena was talking about. They recognize that it couldn't possibly be that only public schools were providing. So they started creating programs like vouchers and others to get other sector, other players involved as well. And I think that leads to a policy, and I alluded to this earlier, which leverages and enhances the underlying structure of providers to basically get them all to kind of rise and compete with each other. And I think that creates a much more vibrant world, which is actually what the world is. I think we make the world black and white when the world is really full of rich colors in providing education. So let me give you two other examples which are related. I love research and evidence, and I think it's critical we generate these studies. But there's a danger that these studies become ossified, and the danger in using words like best buys is that you say, just because this worked in Finland, we're going to apply this in Burundi, mm-hmm. right? And there's a sense in which we export success from one place somewhat blindly into another place. And I think that leads to externally imposed top-heavy reform. Instead, when you recognize that reform is not a product, but it's a process. It's not something you buy off the shelf and you just supply, but it's a process of going through this rigor of saying, who are my actors in my ecosystem? What are the constraints they face? What is the evidence on alleviating those constraints? You do use evidence, but use it in a much smarter way. And that policy becomes about calibrating the knowledge we have as opposed to blindly applying it. And it also demands that we think, both researchers and practitioners in the economy that they're in, at the time they're in, what is the right way to address this problem that we're facing? And the last thing I would say is this notion of focusing on products and best buys forces us to often do this one-size-fits-all kind of approach, right? We want cost efficiency. We want scaling. The easiest way to scale and make something cost-efficient is to create the Lay's potato chip version of education and sell it to everyone because you manufacture it in some little industrial complex and you export it out at scale. Once you recognize that there is beauty in multiplicity, that's not a bug, it's a feature. The fact that education shows up differently in different spaces, from village to village, the school looks slightly different. That's not a failure of standardization. It could be, but much more importantly, if done well, it's an adaptation to the context that you're facing. And so it leads to systems where we trust the local actor much more. I'm not saying we trust them blindly. You can hold people accountable, but you have to give them the resources and autonomy to act. Otherwise, it's not fair to hold people accountable, right? And so I think this idea of creating a more entrepreneurial ecosystem is a very different way of thinking of education policy than the way we typically do this one-size, top-down, rigid, uniform approach. I would say one last thing. I think we're at a critical moment where all of this is actually much easier to do. Emiliana, myself, and Michaela Carlana, who's a fabulous junior colleague of ours who works a lot in middle-income countries and looks at bias in teaching, we've created this initiative at the Center for International Development, or we're beginning to create it. This is probably the first time we're mentioning it in any public sense, called Gear Up. Mm-hmm. And the idea is exactly this, that can we use some of the new tools of data and technology to make an approach, which is the systems-level approach, much more feasible, much more cost-effective. So in other words, can you provide every child a unique way of learning while still having scale economies be at play? And I think the answer is going to be data and technology and AI. Now, that's a longer conversation for another day, but to be continued.
Finally, Emiliana, we're talking about changing institutions, systemic behavior. These things are difficult. They take time. How can you make sure that these policies don't lose momentum?
That's a very hard challenge, particularly because we've just had a terrible global pandemic that led to schools being closed for over a year in many of the countries that we are working in, particularly in the poorest countries. Schools seem to be closed the longest. Latin America, for example, had one of the longest school closures across the board. there's been a lot of effort to try and recover economically and in terms of health outcomes from the pandemic. I think we need to do even a greater effort to get students back on track. The evidence that's coming out across the board, including in the United States and advanced economies where schools were also closed for a long time, about setbacks in learning, particularly for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, is really sobering.
Thank you, Mirjana.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Asim, thank you as well.
Thank you so much. It was really pleasurable. Thank you, Mirjana and Tim, for inviting us to have this conversation.
If you want to find out more about some of the things we've been talking about, well, you can look up LEAP Pakistan, all one word.com to find out about the LEAP program. If you want to look up Emiliana's work, she has published extensively about schooling throughout Latin America and also about learning loss during COVID-19. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.